So before reading the text this morning, I just want to make a couple of notes. First, I want to summarize all of the Old Testament for you in about 2 minutes. God created, mankind rebelled. But God in his love revealed a plan in which he would save fallen sinners. He revealed this plan through promises that he made. And the first of those is back in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, where he said that someday the seed of the woman would defeat Satan. And to say the seed of the woman is an odd statement, given that biblical genealogies, as we're about to see, always track the family line through fathers. God also made a promise sometime later to a man named Abraham that a descendant of Abraham would come, so that God said, in you, in that descendant, in you will all the nations of the earth be blessed. And later a descendant of Abraham named David came, and David was a blessed king, but he was not that promised blessing to the nations. God made another promise to King David, saying that from his descendants would arise a king who would establish an everlasting family, an everlasting kingdom, and would rule on the throne of David forever. And these promises, the people of God had come to expect the arrival of the Messiah or the Christ. Both of those mean the same thing. And so as Matthew writes his gospel to a Jewish audience, he assumes his readers know these things about the Old Testament, and he's not going to be shy about making a bold assertion about the person of Jesus. He says in verse 1, this is the book or the record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Our text this morning is actually going to span from verse 1 all the way down through verse 17, although I recognize that most people look forward to reading a genealogy like this with all the excitement of browsing a bunch of foreign names out of a phone book. I think you'll find that it's better than that. This is the genealogy of Jesus given by Matthew to prove that Jesus is the fulfillment of God's promise in Genesis. And he is that king of Israel promised to David. He is that blessing to all nations that he promised to Abraham. Let me make one other note before we begin the text. Many of the names here are Old Testament names that you may recognize. But since when you read them in the Old Testament, they're coming to us from Hebrew into English, and Matthew is written in Greek, translated into English, the names will sometimes look a bit different. You might, for example, look at the end of verse 9. Ezekias, right? It might not be immediately obvious to you that that's actually King Hezekiah from the Old Testament. And so when I read the text, I'm going to read to you the Old Testament names. It might give a little help. Starting at verse 1. The book of the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham begat Isaac, and Isaac begat Jacob, and Jacob begat Judah and his brethren. And Judah begat Perez and Zerah by Tamar. Perez begat Hezron, and Hezron begat Ram, and Ram begat Amminadab. Amminadab begat Nahshon, and Nahshon begat Salmon. And Salmon begat Boaz by Rahab. Boaz begat Obed of Ruth. Obed begat Jesse, and Jesse begat David the king. David the king begat Solomon of her that had been the wife of Uriah. And Solomon begat Rehoboam, and Rehoboam begat Abiah, and Abiah begat Asa, and Asa begat Jehoshaphat, and Jehoshaphat begat Joram, and Joram begat Uzziah. And Uzziah begat Jotham. Jotham begat Ahaz, and Ahaz begat Hezekiah. And Hezekiah begat Manasseh. Manasseh begat Amon, and Amon begat Josiah, and Josiah begat Jeconiah and his brethren about the time they were carried away to Babylon. And after they were brought to Babylon, Jeconiah begat Shealtiel, and Shealtiel begat Zerubbabel. And Zerubbabel begat Abiud, and Abiud begat Eliakim, and Eliakim begat Azor, and Azor begat Zadok, and Zadok begat Achim, and Achim begat Eliud. And Eliud begat Eleazar, Eleazar begat Mathan, and Mathan begat Jacob, and Jacob begat Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus, who is called Christ. So all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations, and from David unto the carrying away into Babylon are 14 generations, and from the carrying away into Babylon unto Christ are 14 generations. I know biblical genealogies are supposedly boring, but stick with me. This one's not. No promise that I won't end up boring, but the text itself isn't the problem. It uncovers this for us, the scandalous history of Jesus the Messiah. And it may sound like an odd title for a sermon, the scandalous history of Jesus the Messiah, but just wait until we get to some of those names. The names here are vitally important because they are connecting the New Testament with the Old Testament. We've got here 17 verses covering 42 generations, a total of 51 names over the span of 2,000 years. And the names on this list include men and women. It includes Jews and Gentiles. It includes the highest and the lowest of society, from kings all the way down to shepherds. And it is a listing of scandal and sin with the faults and failings of humanity written in. Even the most righteous names on this list are abject failures at satisfying God, with the singular exception of one man. The genealogy begins in verse 1 and ends in verse 16 with the same name, the name which is above every name, the name at which every knee in heaven and earth and under the earth will bow, Jesus Christ. His given name is Jesus. That is, in the Hebrew language, Yeshua. The same as Joshua in the Old Testament. And their name means Yahweh is salvation. What a perfect name for this perfect man. His title is Christ. He is the anointed, that means. It's the same as the Old Testament word Messiah. And so this is the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah. It is the absolute proof of his authority, and it entitles him alone to the throne of David. Such a genealogy would have been demanded by the Jews at the time that Matthew was writing. In fact, I wish that so many Jewish people today who think that the New Testament is just some mere Christian fabrication would just open up the first verse and read it. This is Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. You don't get more Jewish than this. This is precisely why, when the books of the New Testament were collated together, Matthew is placed first. These words are designed to be a bridge between the Old Testament and the New Testament. The promise of the Messiah and the coming of the Messiah. As Matthew writes to a Jewish audience, he begins here because this is evidence that they would have demanded to see. You know, you realize any one of us could give ourselves the title of king and even designate where the scope of our reign is. But if you do that, you better be able to back up the claim. You'd better be able to prove it. Not only has God designed this genealogy here in order to prove that Jesus is the son of David and the son of Abraham, God also, historically, we understand, he immediately shut down any potential for someone else to claim this heritage. About 40 years after Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection, the Roman army comes and it destroys the city of Jerusalem, and the genealogical records like this were wiped from history. There are Jews to this day who are still awaiting the Messiah, but they must know that there will never be a child born who can establish a claim like this. The record of the Messiah's genealogy was written down, and then all other records of it, of such things, got destroyed. So that you either accept Jesus as the Messiah, or you'll never be able to accept anyone as the Messiah. It's impossible that there'll ever be another verifiable claim to this title, the Son of David, the Son of Abraham. That is not to say that in this text, Matthew has given us every single generation between Abraham and Jesus. In fact, he has not done that. He did not intend to do that. It's not necessary. You can see in verse 17, he describes to us that he's giving 14 distinct proofs in three different eras of Jewish history in the Old Testament. He says from Abraham to David, he's given 14 generations. And from David to the Babylonian captivity at the end of verse 11, he's given 14 generations. And from the restoration from captivity until the coming of Jesus, he gives another 14 proofs. He's simply saying, look, this is more than adequate evidence. He had access to all the names. For example, at the end of verse 8, between Joram and Uzziah, we all know, if we study the Old Testament, Matthew knows as well that there were kings Ahaziah and Joash and Amaziah. But he's left them off the list. He doesn't need to put down every single name. When he says Joram begat Uzziah, begat simply means Joam is the ancestor of Uzziah. And that's inarguably true. It's proof enough. And so what's fascinating then is Matthew has made decisions about which proofs he will include in this genealogy. We can look at the choices that he made and see who he includes and who he leaves out, and we understand why. He makes choices here that no other writer in Scripture makes, including women in this genealogy on five different occasions. And as he does it, he includes prostitutes and adulterers and liars and thieves and murderers and even at least one man who was specifically cursed by God. When we come to the end, we find out this genealogy of Christ is not the genealogy of his bloodline at all. Remember, that word begat means that he's the ancestor of. Well, look at verse 16. And see that Jacob is the ancestor of Joseph. Where does it say that Joseph is the ancestor of Jesus? It simply says Joseph was the husband of Mary, of whom of Mary was born Jesus, who is called Christ the Messiah. So legally speaking, Joseph is the adoptive father of Jesus, but he's not Jesus' father by birth. Matthew tells us that right here. And if you want a record, by the way, of the physical ancestry of Jesus, you can go to Luke's gospel and read Luke's genealogy, where he gives the descendants to Jesus through his birth mother, his mother, Mary. And I promise to point out later where Luke and Matthew's genealogies diverge. Matthew gives the genealogy of Jesus through his adoptive father, Joseph, and you might be shocked as we go through it to find out just why that was so important. We could read this and we might be tempted to call it the victorious and wonderful heritage of Jesus the Messiah, but I'm telling you, this is not a family tree to be proud of. You know, more than one person has started looking up their family genealogy and found out some shocking detail about an ancestor that they were not eager to claim. If we went back through your family for 42 generations, what kind of scoundrels do you think we would uncover? There isn't an occasional black sheep in this family. Verses 1 through 16 is an entire flock of black sheep from whom the perfect Lamb of God miraculously came. So let's just look at some of these names in this genealogy and see why it's a scandalous heritage. In verse 2, Abraham is the first name. Abraham was an idol worshiper. He was called by God, and he was given that precious promise that we spoke about. But he was also an adulterer. At one point, he left his wife, Sarah, to languish in the harem of an Egyptian king that he was afraid of. Abraham fathered a child by a servant girl and eventually banished both that girl and her child. His son Isaac would be raised to have faith in God, but Isaac would also be frequently disobedient. Isaac's two sons, Jacob and Esau, Isaac was so determined to bless the older son Esau, contrary to the command of God, that he had to be tricked into giving Jacob the blessing. And in that process, Jacob, you see him there in verse 2, Jacob proved himself to be a deceitful little mama's boy. He was just as wicked as his older brother, but by God's grace, he was blessed. God would rename Jacob Israel, and his 12 sons would become the 12 tribes of Israel. That's what verse 2 is describing when it says that he begat Judah and his brothers. But this is where the real smutty part of the family history starts. Look at verse 3. Judah begat Perez and Zerah by Tamar. This is where we find the first woman mentioned in this record. Are you familiar with this story? It is one of the most disgusting accounts in Scripture. Genesis 38 records how this girl, Tamar, was married to one of Judah's sons. I mean, you want to find a story where there's no good guys, just read Genesis 38 and you'll find it. Judah had three sons, and he married off his oldest son to this girl named Tamar, but they were childless, and when that son died, the next son was legally obligated to marry Tamar and have children by her. But that second son, Onan, refused to do it. He abused Tamar by having a sexual relationship with her, but in one of the most ugly and disgusting and graphic accounts in the Bible, refused to have a child with her. And that mistreatment angered the Lord so much that he killed Onan. And now Tamar should have been married off to the third brother, but he was considered to be too young. So Judah just told her, look, just wait. He's going to grow up and he's going to be old enough. You just wait. Your father-in-law, Judah, is going to take care of you. Seems he never intended to have his family do the right thing by that woman. He was content to have her mistreated and cast aside and forgotten. And so instead, she disguised herself as a prostitute. And when her father-in-law, Judah, comes by, she seduces her own father-in-law. He does not recognize her. He agrees to pay her later and left his ring and his bracelet and his staff as security. He didn't know he had just slept with his daughter-in-law, Tamar. And when he sends a servant back with the payment, she's gone. Well, in more than a coincidence, Tamar becomes pregnant with her father-in-law's child. When Judah found out that Tamar was pregnant, he was furious, right? Judah thinks, well, how dare this woman be unfaithful to my son's memory and bring shame on my family? And he says, bring her out here. We're going to execute her. But before that could happen, Tamar pulls out the ring and the bracelet and the staff that he had left and said, look, I'm with child by the man who owns these. Do you recognize them? That saves her life, and it produces these two twin boys that she gives birth to, Perez and Zerah, mentioned in verse 3. If you're like many other folks who have read Genesis 38 and thought, just yuck, why is this here? Why do I have to read this? Well, here's why you have to read this. It is a vital connection to the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah. And you might remember the birth of those two boys, how during delivery, Zara's hand came out first, making him the older brother. And the midwife tied a little scarlet cord, a scarlet thread to his hand. And then the hand goes back in and the babies tumble around a little bit. And Perez was born. This unique occurrence where the younger brother was born before the older brother. There's just a lot of unique stuff in this genealogy. Not the least of which is the sad life of these two little boys living with the shame of their parentage. If you realize if you ask those boys, Perez and Zara, you know, who's your dad, they would point to Judah. And if you said, who's your grandpa, they would still point to Judah. It's not a proud heritage. It's a scandal. And in the middle of the scandal, you have names like, at the end of verse 3, Hezron and Ram. And we know nothing about them except what we just read there in verse 3. They are nobodies as far as history is concerned. But Jesus, the Messiah, came from nobodies so that he could save a bunch of nobodies. In verse 4, you have Amminadab, whose only claim to fame was that he was the father-in-law of Moses' brother Aaron. You also have Nashon and Salmon are mentioned as leaders of the tribe of Judah. And after that short break, verse 5 picks up with the scandal again. Salmon begat Boaz of Rahab. You remember Rahab? She's not even a Jew. She was a Gentile. In the land of Canaan that was so sinful that God commanded everyone should be destroyed, Rahab was more sinful than most. Unlike Tamar, who just pretended to be a prostitute one time, Rahab made a life of it. She plied her trade there while living in a house that was built inside the walls surrounding Jericho. Her living was catering to traveling men who had trekked down the highway and crossed the Jordan River. She was living a life of absolute sin, separated from God, not only by her Gentile birth, but also her lascivious lifestyle. And so when two spies of Israel cross the Jordan River, they're naturally not going to try to hide in the king's house. They sought out what they considered to be the least respectable of people where they could hide, and they found Rahab. But they also found that she had heard about the God of Israel. She told the spies, "For the Lord your God is God in heaven above and in earth below." The spies promised to return the favor by saving Rahab and her family from the battle to come as long as they stayed inside the home that was in the walls of Jericho. Give some kind of signal that would let the Israelites know it was her. And so when the battle came, Rahab hung a scarlet thread, another scarlet thread in the story, hung it out of her home as a signal that she was inside, and God himself gave the greatest of signs because as the walls of Jericho come tumbling down, the single home remaining standing is the one that has the scarlet cord hanging out the window. God saved Rahab alive. Why? Well, Matthew's genealogy gives us the answer to that. She was part of God's plan for more than conquering Jericho, right? As Joshua was leading the Old Testament Israelites into Jericho to conquer the land, she was part of God's eternal plan to conquer sin through the perfect descendant of hers, Jesus the Messiah. Her descendant Boaz would become the main character of the book of Ruth. You see that again in verse 5. Salmon begat Boaz of Rahab. Boaz begat Obed of Ruth. Ruth's another Gentile. Worse yet, she's a Moabite woman. The Moabites were all descendants of this incestuous relationship between Lot and one of his daughters. This is such a shameful ancestry that there was at least one man who was supposed to have married Ruth before Boaz, but he told Boaz, I'm not going to ruin my perfect name by associating with her. It is no great honor having this Gentile Moabite woman to be in your family tree. But then in verse 6, we would hope that it would get better after all. In verse 6, we have David the king. This is the son of Jesse that God chose to be the king of Israel. God rejected the 7 oldest sons of Jesse. But there was one more boy, a freckle-faced little runt named David. And you realize, of course, I would never call that to his face. Nobody would have looked at David and wanted him to be king. But the prophet said, man does not see as God sees. Man looks at the outward appearance, but God looks at the heart. And the genealogy now should start getting cleaned up a little bit, except that it doesn't. In verse 6, David the king begat Solomon by her that had been the wife of Uriah. This story is so infamous that Matthew doesn't even have to include the name of that woman who we know to be Bathsheba. In fact, just ask yourself, why is this here? Why doesn't it just say that David begat Solomon? Wouldn't that be true enough? Matthew's calling our attention to these things. He wants us to read this and know what kind of smutty story it is that we're reading. David had a son named Solomon, but he had Solomon by a woman named Bathsheba who was another man's wife. And though she was the granddaughter of David's most trusted advisor, David saw her and he lusted after her and he called her to him and he got her pregnant. And then to cover that up, he has Uriah, her husband, who was a good and faithful soldier in his army. David has Uriah murdered. The stories here, just by verse 6, they're just as ugly as can be. And we come to Solomon. I promised earlier that I'd point out where Luke and Matthew's genealogy diverge. Well, here it is. Matthew is going to go on to trace the legal genealogy of Jesus through David's son Solomon. Luke traces Jesus' physical genealogy through another of David's sons, Nathan. Nathan is Solomon's older brother. Starting here and going through about 1,000 years of history, there are these parallel family lines from Nathan and Solomon. But they have to come together again if there is going to be a son of David who rules as king. The history of Solomon is so confounding that the wisest Bible scholars end up flummoxed trying to explain his life. He just confounds the imagination and how far a man can fall because he started so well. He builds the temple for God. God blesses Solomon. He offers Solomon the gift of whatever he wants. And Solomon wisely asked for more wisdom and it was granted to him. And so wiser than any other man to that point in history, I'm convinced Jesus himself is the only one who had more wisdom than Solomon. But it shows us that the wisest man is not all that wise. The wisest man is still a man. Solomon fell into a life of sin and debauchery and pleasure. To underscore the moral failings of Solomon, we simply need to say this. He started collecting foreign women as if they were possessions. And to keep them happy, he would take their idols, their false gods, into Israel and even set them up inside the temple of God. the nation would not really survive the damage done by Solomon. After Solomon's death, his son Rehoboam, you see him there in verse 7. Rehoboam assumes the throne, but he's so unwise that the kingdom of Israel gets divided. Right early on, just two generations after David, his grandson Rehoboam, the lineage of David starts to lose its luster. It falls and it keeps falling. Because when Rehoboam becomes king, he is king. He should be king of all Israel, but instead of being king of all 12 tribes, he is so unwise that 10 of the tribes abandon him. He's left as king of only Judah and Benjamin. And there's going to be 20 more kings of those two little tribes that descend from him. Not all of them are listed here, but all the names in verses 7 through 11 are the names of kings, the royal line of David. And admittedly, there's a few of them that were relatively good, but most of them weren't. I just saved some time by giving you the one-word summary of some of the worst of these guys, starting in verse 7. Here's the one-word summaries of them: bad, perverted, terrible, bad again, devilish, and then there's a few good names until we get back to words like heinous, depraved, treacherous, dreadful, degenerate, frightening, and stupid. That sounds like the list of dwarves from a Disney movie nobody would ever want to see. But there are two of these guys in particular I need to tell you about. One of them is left off of Matthew's list. There's a king named Jehoiakim. In verse 11, he would fit in there toward the beginning between Josiah and Jeconiah. There was a man named Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim was king of Judah. Unlike some of the folks on this list who tried to obey and just failed, Jehoiakim really hated God, hated God's word, hated God's prophets. Jehoiakim is the king who took the scroll of the prophet Jeremiah and cut it up and threw it in the fire. In the book of Jeremiah, God tells Jehoiakim that he's going to be taken off of the throne, killed, and his body is going to get tossed over the wall of Jerusalem to rot in the sun. God says, I will punish him and his descendants forever. Punish him and his descendants. Well, we go, well, no wonder this is one of the names that Matthew left off the list. Right? He would want to hide a curse like that. But listen, he's not hiding it. Matthew didn't put Jehoiakim on the list because his son Jeconiah was even more famously cursed by God. Jeconiah is found right there in verse 11. But if you've got that bookmark in Jeremiah 22, let's go look at it for a second. Jeremiah 22, he's referred to as Coniah, but starting at verse 24, as I live, says the Lord, though Coniah, the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, were the signet upon my right hand, yet I will pluck you thence, and I will give you into the hand of them that seek your life, and into the hand of them whose face you fear, even into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and into the hand of the Chaldeans. And I will cast you out, and your mother that bare you, into another country where you were not born, and there shall you die. But to the land whereunto they desire to return, thither shall they not return. Is this man Coniah a despised broken idol? Is he a vessel wherein is no pleasure? Wherefore, why are they cast out, he and his seed, and are cast into a land which they know not? Oh, earth, 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 hear the word of the Lord. Thus saith the Lord, write you this man childless, a man that shall not prosper in his days, for no man of his seed shall prosper sitting upon the throne of David and ruling any more in Judah. And with that curse, God ended the line of David's dynasty on the throne. The very God who promised a descendant of David who would rule and reign forever, that same God looks at the royal line of David and says to King Jeconiah, that's it, it's over. I'm done with you and everybody who comes from you. Not a single one of your descendants will sit on the throne of David. And they don't. But that presents us with a conundrum, right? God promised the son of David to rule and reign on his throne forever, and then God promises that no son of this royal bloodline is going to sit on his throne. But remember, this is Matthew's legal genealogy, right? Jesus is going to be adopted into this line to claim the throne. Luke, in his genealogy, is recording the actual bloodline. And remember, we said that back there where Solomon, David's son, is listed in Matthew, that Luke starts tracing the genealogy of David's other son, Nathan. And so there's these parallel lines that are running down through history. God remembers this. In fact, if you're still there in Jeremiah 22, you can just look over at chapter 23, verse 5 and 6. Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will raise unto David a righteous branch. A king shall reign and prosper, and shall execute judgment and justice in the earth. In his days, Judah shall be saved, Israel shall dwell safely. And this is his name whereby he shall be called, the Lord our righteousness, or Yahweh our righteousness. The lineage of David's older son, Nathan, it descends parallel with this, unthought of, unnoticed, all the way down to a virgin girl named Mary, who is the physical descendant of David, who is espoused to this young man named Joseph. So physically, Jesus is the physical descendant of David, able to assume the throne, and yet he is not descended through Jeconiah, who God said that he was going to cut off him and all of his descendants. He is adopted into that part of the family tree, free from the curse of Jeconiah. Does that all seem a little bit complex? It's the best I can do to pull back the curtain and reveal to you this just divine mastermind, this sovereign genius who has planned this before he promised it to Abraham or to David, long before he cursed Jeconiah, long before he blessed Mary. Go back to our genealogy in Matthew 1, so we're almost out of time. Verse 12, the kingdom gets restored again under a man named Zerubbabel. You might remember he's the governor of Judah when Ezra returns from captivity. He's not king. But Zerubbabel is really the final name we know. The rest of those names in the genealogy, all of those men lived between the close of the Old Testament and the opening of the New Testament. So that even in those 400 years where God was silent, God was still there. God was still working. He was silent, but he was working silently. Listen, there is no other man in history than Jesus who could fulfill this plan. As God is the divine mastermind devising this plan throughout history, unnoticed by you and me, what do you suppose that sovereign genius is working today? But as I'll tell you, just like we separate time into before Jesus' birth and then in the days after Jesus' birth, every moment of history of humanity past was flowing forward toward Jesus, and every moment of human history since has been flowing out from Jesus. And yet when we read this genealogy and we see what it looks like, what are we really looking at? It's far more shameful than it is beautiful. It's much more scandalous than it is righteous. You study these names and you find one story after another that is shady and smutty, depravity of every kind. There's prostitutes and liars and thieves. It ranges from stained virtue at best to wicked rebels at worst. There's deceit and debauchery. There's adultery and murder. There's idol worshipers. There's wicked leaders. There's ultimately a man who's outright cursed by God. Don't think that that's all just in the past. The depravity of mankind has not gotten any better going forward. In all of human history, there was one sole bright spot, and we murdered him. The record of this genealogy is like setting Jesus on a backdrop to shine. There's one preacher described it as a black cloth. If you've ever went shopping for a diamond, which I've done one time in my life, and poor Joy is the one who has got the pathetic result of that search. If you've ever gone diamond shopping, you know the jeweler's going to bring out a piece of black cloth, and then he's going to set the diamond down on top of it, and by shining a light, you can see every beautiful facet of that diamond. Listen, that's what the scandalous genealogy does. From Abraham to David and Solomon to Jeconiah, every sinful king, every pregnant prostitute, every forgotten name, every lie, every adultery and murder, it lays out the black nature of mankind. And Jesus Christ is set like a diamond on it, this perfect jewel, the light of the world himself, shining out every perfect facet of God's grace. Listen, the record of your life and mine is equally black. If who you are and where you came from and what you've done were written down on a page, would you want us to come in here and read it out loud? Would you want the shameful history of your family and the events of your life spread out for all the world to see? More importantly, what are you going to do when you answer to God, when he picks up the book of your life? Just picture a book that's labeled, you know, here are the words and works of Jason Schultz, except this book has your name on it instead. And you open up that book and you read that there's just this black history of your life, which is no better than the scandalous heritage we see here. The book would begin, Jason was born as a sinful son to sinful parents in a sinful family tree. He grew up in an immoral neighborhood, part of a wicked country, in an entirely evil world. And when he began to talk, wicked words came out of his mouth. When he learned to walk, his feet took him to evil places. Every thought of his heart was nothing but evil continually. And what follows is an account of every action and thought and every word of your life. None of it good. But now here's Jesus, who's come into the world in such a miraculous way as this. And the book that's labeled The Words and Works of Jesus Christ, it is a good book. Every chapter is glorious. He was promised to be perfect. He was born perfect. He behaved perfectly. Despite being surrounded by debauchery, he lived above it and he lifted others above it. He spoke the beloved words of God's grace, and yet he came to bear my sin. He bore your wickedness to give you his righteousness. The exchange of your wickedness for his righteousness is like Jesus is just switched the dust covers on the books, took your sin and bore it to the death and punishment that you deserved. And through faith in Jesus Christ, the Son of God, I know the day is coming where God is going to open up the book that says the words and works of Jason Schultz on the outside. But instead of all my sin and all my failure, Jesus has switched the covers, and it's going to be, here's the words and works of Jesus. Here's his marvelous grace. Here's his wonderful goodness. Here's his perfection. What a glorious gift. Matthew wants us to know this. before in verse 18 where he says, now the birth of Jesus was on this wise. Before you think about the birth of Jesus, think about this. You have to know this. This is a time to contemplate him and to trust him. It is foolish not to trust him. Such rejection comes with the most dire of consequences. And so I plead with you, embrace Jesus by believing on him. Because this list starts with his name and ends with his name. And in all of history, his name is the only one worth trusting.